compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello, and welcome back. Thank you for listening. 888-914-9149. I want to share a story with you. It's about Christopher Fidelis Moshinsky. He's a Franciscan friar, and this is courtesy of BuzzFeed News, by the way. He's accused of using five locks to chain the gates of a Planned Parenthood before lying down in front of it to prevent access. He is 52 years old. He was sent to federal court in Brooklyn, and that is taking place, I believe. Yeah, no, this will be tomorrow. And he's accused of violating a 1994 law that guarantees the freedom of access to clinic entrances. So I'm asking you to please pray for him. He was, this according, and keep in mind, this is BuzzFeed. So this is not a Catholic coverage of the story. The defendant, according to U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Breon Peace, said in a statement, the defendant attempted to prevent women from accessing their legal right to vital reproductive and pregnancy services. This office will enforce federal law to protect clinics and staff that provide reproductive health services while safeguarding the rights of their patients. According to the criminal complaint on the morning of July the 7th, Moshinsky, and I believe he is a priest, so we can assume that. Cyrus, if you don't mind looking that up for me, I'd sure appreciate knowing that. I want to make sure I'm as clear as possible on this. He was seen on surveillance footage using two chains with padlocks and three bicycle locks to secure the gates around the Planned Parenthood Health Center. And this is in Hempstead, Long Island. Witnesses said that some of the locks had glue poured into them. When an employee arrived and discovered the scene, he or she called the authorities, who swiftly arrived to remove the locks. When he was approached by a police officer, Moshinsky then lay down in front of the clinic and physically blocked access. He was subsequently arrested for disorderly conduct. And this is what's happening with him. So we'll see what happens about that. The thing to remember is, thanks, Cyrus, he is a Catholic priest. Looks like he's a member of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. A gentleman on Twitter who posted this, he posted this saying, Father Fidelis Moshinsky will face trial today for campaigning against abortion outside a Planned Parenthood clinic in Pennsylvania. If convicted of felony charges, the priest would potentially face 16 years in prison. Please remember this brave priest in your prayers. He was unfairly charged with three crimes: misdemeanor resisting arrest, felony trespass, and felony conspiracy to trespass. Each felony carries a maximum of 7 years imprisonment, and the misdemeanor 2 years. Therefore, if convicted today, Father Fidelis may potentially face up to 16 years in prison. So yes, indeed, do pray that the judge and or jury will be merciful to him. Which raises the question, if you ask me, is that the right way to go about trying to do something good? And he was no doubt doing something very good by trying to oppose abortion. Is that the right way to do it? And I don't personally think it is. You know, I don't in any way seek to take away from his own courage in facing up against abortion. But there's certain, and the reason I say I don't think it is not because there's anything necessarily inherently wrong with, you know, putting a chain on this, although it is illegal, that's true. The question is it immoral? But what does it accomplish? I think that's the goal that we all would like to see move forward, and that is, you know, let's accomplish something positive in shutting down abortion. How do we do that? Well, here at Relevant Radio, of course, we are trying to do something in the form of prayer with the hundreds and hundreds of millions of memoraries asking Our Lady to pray for us for an end of legal abortion in this country. I think that has had some effect. I mean, could it be just a coincidence that after hundreds of millions of memoraries, Roe versus Wade gets overturned? I think there must be some connection there. We're not taking all the credit, that's for sure. But I think it has a role to play. And changing people's hearts and minds, doing everything we possibly can do legally, nonviolently, to oppose abortion. But the reason I say that, you know, if it were me, and if he had said, you know, hey, you know, over a cup of coffee, you know, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, what do you think? I would say I wouldn't do that. I mean, there are other things you can do. But first of all, I mean, you're a Catholic priest. We need you. We need you doing what you're ordained to do and living in community. Your brothers need you. The community needs you. So if by doing this, you're going to wind up going away for 16 years, who does that benefit? How does that help the cause? I mean, I understand there are times when you have to, and I don't want to say make a spectacle of yourself, but you have to take a stand knowing that people are going to notice it and not all of them are going to like it. And I don't in any way oppose that. But there are other ways of going about doing this. So I really do hope and pray that this is not going to wind up in a jail sentence. Maybe they'll give him probation or something like that. I mean, they do that for other people, don't they? So
how about this guy, you know, getting, what is it? Did you say 16 years?
Well, it could be as many as 16 years if he were convicted.
For putting glue in a lock?
No. For chaining the doors of the abortion clinic.
Okay.
And impeding access by preventing people from going into it.
And this is following a year of riots and buildings being burned.
Yeah.
With no repercussions that I'm aware of.
Very few.
Very few, anyway.
Yeah. Spray painting federal buildings, tearing down statues, destroying public property, even private property at will, just because you're angry.
But they weren't messing with Planned Parenthood, so it was okay.
That's right.
Okay.
You see how it goes. This is what you get when you mess with us.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So I don't want to be misunderstood, and your point is well taken, Cyrus, too, about the ridiculous disparity between how people like the Antifa clowns and all of that nonsense and all the destruction and mayhem and how they were, you know, essentially just sort of let go or not really pursued very much. And yet a Catholic priest who's trying to make an important statement about the evil of abortion, let's just hope they don't throw the book at him. So I get that point. But my point is, what did Jesus say? Jesus said, be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Now, snakes are not wise in the sense that human beings are wise. It's an analogy. But I think that is a passage that comes into play here. Is it wise to do something like that? Does that actually accomplish something that in the long run is a net gain? Or is it symbolic and results in a net loss? And my impression, based upon the facts that I've read about the story, is that it would be more the latter than the former. So we have to, you know, we're in it to win it. And let's do those things that really have an opportunity or a chance at moving the ball forward, to mix my metaphors yet again. That's something I think we should always keep in mind. I have tremendous sympathy for him and empathy for him. And I hope indeed that the court is merciful with him. But if somebody were to ask me, hey, do you think it would be a good idea to chain an abortion clinic door? I would say no. No, because you're not going to, you will not save anybody. And you will actually, in some ways, only retard the progress of the movement to end legal abortion. So that's my reaction to that.
Yeah, you're right. It fuels the other side. Say, look, see what they do?
Yeah. Now, let me play devil's advocate of my own position. I'm going to argue against my own position now. You ready? So the Freedom Riders in Alabama, for example, in the 1950s, it was illegal, according to the local statutes, for blacks to sit in a seat that a white person wanted. And blacks were supposed to sit in the back of the bus. And, of course, we know all the horror stories of the Jim Crow terror that was enacted in communities all across the South, where there were whites-only bathrooms and whites-only restaurants and whites-only, you name it, you know, if it was a place of public commerce or restaurants or something like that, black people were forced to use separate facilities. And that stupid separate but equal notion that was masquerading as some kind of equality, that went along with it. So the Freedom Riders, the ones who rode on these buses and intentionally wouldn't give up their seat to a white person, or they wouldn't consent to sit in the back of the bus, or they wouldn't consent to go use the black-only restroom, they use the white-only. So in other words, they were testing the laws, they were breaking the laws, And in many cases, these were just like local statutes. So it wasn't like federal law, although in the case of this abortion clinic, that is a federal law. But the point is, they were doing something. But I think the difference here is it actually was accomplishing something. It was actually changing the minds and the hearts of people in sufficient numbers that when the civil rights movement really got going in the 1960s, Martin Luther King and the other significant figures, it actually accomplished something that it required this civil disobedience to get to that point. So I do see that there are times and places where that is necessary and it can be very effective. I just don't think that chaining the doors to an abortion clinic is one of those things. I don't think it moves the ball in any further down the road. And if anything, it just complicates matters. So, hey, I just argued against my own position.
And you won your own argument. Nice work.
See how that works? 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Erica in Pittsburgh. Hello, Erica.
Oh, hi, Patrick. Sorry. Hi. Just trying to switch you off of speaker. Sorry.
Okay.
I have a question today about receiving communion in the hand, so
okay,
versus in the mouth from the priest's hand.
Okay.
And and it comes from a conversation I had with two lovely ladies I know, and they felt they were expressing their sense that it was wrong to receive in the hand to the point of sinfulness, and they quoted Mother Teresa saying it was worse than abortion to receive in the hand, which I had never heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
And I had responded in some ways to them, but I wasn't sure if my responses were sufficient. And I felt like I would like to hear from you more about that issue.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, let me do this. Talk about playing devil's advocate. I'll put my cards on the table, first of all, by saying I myself only receive Holy Communion on the tongue. I never receive in the hand. And I strongly prefer and I encourage people to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. I don't look down on anybody who receives Holy Communion in the hand. The church permits it. It was once regarded in the years after Vatican II when this began to emerge, or I should say reemerge, because it was practiced in the early church, it was treated as a liturgical aberration. It was an abuse. And it was tolerated and tolerated and tolerated, and eventually it was permitted. So I want to emphasize the fact that the church does permit this. And I want people to be clear that I don't look down on them, but I personally much prefer to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. Now, what's interesting, and this is where I mean by talking like in a devil's advocate voice. I recently read a new article that came out called Early Christian Communion in the Hand by Elizabeth Klein. And this is from the University of Notre Dame in their Church Life Journal. So it's a new article and it's an historical overview. It's looking at the patristic era and it's looking at how much did the early Christians actually receive Holy Communion in the hand? And it was prevalent in some cases, and it was prevalent for a lot longer than I think most people realize. So I want to acknowledge the fact that there is scholarship that's out there, and this is about the newest scholarship I've found on the topic, that supports the view that by citing church fathers on this topic, that the church fathers who are cited, that they regarded communion in the hand to be sufficiently respectful, and that it was not disrespectful to receive Holy Communion on the hand. And people such as St. Cyril of Jerusalem and St. Augustine and various other significant church fathers, St. Cyprian, Tertullian, Cyril of Alexandria, John Chrysostom, John Damascene. So it's quite a lengthy list of church fathers who had comments to make on the topic, all of whom are preeminent, well, maybe with the exception of Tertullian, considered church fathers in any case. So I think to be fair, even though my preference is not to receive Holy Communion in the hand, if I'm going to be fair, I have to point you toward this resource that tells the other side of the story and shows that in the minds of these great church fathers, they didn't see a problem with communion in the hand. So the last thing I'll say, Erica, is I maintain my view that I much prefer Holy Communion on the tongue, because I believe, so that we don't fall into a kind of antiquarian fallacy and assume that just because they did things a certain way in the early church, therefore it must be better. It's not always the case. I mean, their penances, for example, were public in the early church. If you committed a serious sin, people could figure out probably pretty clearly what your sin was by what your penance was, because the penance were imposed and they were public in nature, typically, like not being admitted to Holy Communion for a year or 5 years. And if you had to stand in the back of the church where all those who were under the imposition of a public penance like that, people could figure out pretty quickly what it was that you did that would earn you that kind of a punishment, or a penance rather. I don't want to return to that. I don't think we should return to that. Just because it was done that way in the early church doesn't mean that it should be done now, which leads me to this final point, and that is Catholic sacramental theology and in the church's piety, and more specifically here, the church's piety, enjoys a kind of organic growth. And although the theology itself doesn't change and the truths contained in the theology don't change, the church's way of living out these beautiful mysteries of the faith does change. And so the organic development in both the Western church and certainly in the Eastern churches, it grew away from communion in the hand. It just became something you'd never see, even though it was practiced in the patristic era, as this article amply demonstrates. The church moved on from that. And my point is that I see something really important about that, that this organic development, this maturing in deepening in the understanding of what's taking place, led the church to move entirely away from communion in the hand. And furthermore, in the Eastern Catholic churches, the Byzantine Rite, for example, it's unthinkable to receive communion in the hand. One reason is practical, and that's because they commingle the Eucharistic bread and the precious blood in the chalice, and it's spooned into your mouth. So you're not going to touch it at all because it's spooned into your mouth. And this is true in the Eastern Orthodox churches as well. So there's something that we should contemplate, and that is, if both in the East and the West, the church moved on from communion in the hand, and this organic development and deepening and maturation of the church's understanding of what's taking place here moved in a different direction, I think that should be respected personally. And I think that some people can fall prey to this antiquarian fallacy in which they think, oh, well, because they did that in the early church, therefore that must be superior. We should do that again. That's certainly not always the case. Now, that's a long answer, Erica, but I wanted to share that with you so you had more to go on.
I appreciate that. I often give long answers also. So So thank you very much for that. Elizabeth Klein, that was the author of that book that you mentioned.
Well, it's an article, yeah. And it's found...
An article that you mentioned, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Klein, it's October 13th of this year. It's in churchlifejournal.nd.edu. So it's a subset of Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame. And the title of the article is Early Christian Communion in the Hand. So it's a survey of the patristic era of not only the phenomenon, but also what those church fathers had to say about it. And as I say, I don't like this and I don't favor it, but I want to be fair and not withhold some important information just because it doesn't fit my narrative, you know.
So we attend a parish where we, at every Mass, we receive communion at the rail, and that continued with COVID, which is where the issue came up a lot for these lovely ladies, where mm-hmm. their parish would not do that anymore, and they went looking for a parish that would. And so yeah. I am very much in sync with your thoughts about that, but here is another concern that kind of seemed to open a door that this concern of theirs felt to me. And maybe I'm wrong, and you can correct me, where there is a way in, I felt, well, people are not wrong to receive it. The bishops have approved it. And there's a way in which we trust in the authority of the church, mm-hmm. not necessarily John the bishop as the man, but that authority that's been passed on to him. And that when we decide on our own to separate from that authority and to deny that authority, we open the door to, and I'm not saying they're on the verge of schism, but I'm saying on the road to schism, it begins with these little thoughts and ideas where we decide my feelings about this, which I agree with their feelings. I much prefer receiving communion that way. I think that's a better way. I wish we all adored and revered the sacrament in that way and that we all felt that way. But the concern I felt was the distrust in the bishops. And while clearly bishops make mistakes and priests make mistakes and they say things that are wrong or even maybe heretical, who knows? But there is a way that we have to place our trust in the authority of the church and the continuity of the church based on Christ's promises to us.
That's true. And I wish I could talk longer on this topic, Erica, but I do have to take a break. So forgive my brevity here. That's true. I think that that this issue maybe is a bit more complex than that only. And the scandals among bishops and cardinals and priests have certainly exacerbated the lay people's, at least those who are paying attention, it has exacerbated and already maybe a state of misgiving about what is the bishop doing, or why is he doing this, or why is the priest saying this? It may be okay what has been said or done, but there is now an air of suspicion and deep disappointment on the part of some lay people anyway. And so that could be part of, and probably is part of, this resistance to following along with, the say, a mandate to receive Holy Communion in the hand. There's a lot more to say about it, Erica, and I'm glad you brought it up, really, because it's one of those important topics that we probably should think about even more than we do. Thank you for adding your voice to the conversation. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we got the beat here at the Patrick Madrid Show. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call to be on the air.
Hey, Patrick.
Yeah.
I just got an email from John. Have you seen this?
John,
the subject line. The subject line is "Blood on Your Hands, Really."
Yeah, okay. I see it in my inbox. Just came in.
Yeah, so this is responding to, you talked about this yesterday, about you had an email from someone that was very unhappy with you.
Yeah.
All right, and so this guy is responding to that email.
And now that I'm looking at this email, I probably should explain what that email was. That it was a long email from a listener who said that I had blood on my hands and I had committed terrible sins and I had to atone for my sins because I had questioned Donald Trump's, questioned his, whether he was really pro-life or not. And in so doing, I aided and abetted Joe Biden, et cetera, et cetera. None of which was true. It seems to me that there was a time when maybe it was because somebody asked about this on the program, whether or not he was really pro-life. And how would I know? I mean, I don't know him. I don't know his mind, and I don't know the heart of any person. And I don't remember exactly what the conversation included, but I do remember something along the lines of asking out loud, is there anything in his past, you know, in his business ventures and family life and other things that whatever he's done, and I, by no means am I an expert on his background, but it didn't seem to me that there was anything that was, you know, outwardly pro-life. I never noticed anything about his life prior to running for office that was pro-life. So if that's what this gentleman's referring to, okay, I guess, but that's not promoting Joe Biden. So anyway, he leaped to a completely wrong conclusion, completely erroneous in every respect. And that's what I read on the air yesterday and responded to briefly. So Right. This is a response to that.
This is,
like?
And this is from John, and he says, "Patrick, anyone who thinks Patrick T. Madrid has blood on his hands is delusional. I have listened to your show whenever possible for the past 3 years. As a radio junkie, I know from whence I speak. While I frequently disagree with you," and that's true because we see a lot, we see him disagree with you quite frequently. "While I frequently disagree with you, I have always found you to be eminently fair when addressing any of your listeners who espouse alternative viewpoints. You are a fine model for young people, whatever their belief systems, and I just know your parents provided great examples when you were growing up. I seldom give compliments." That's funny. "I seldom give compliments to anyone, so you can believe when I say you are one of the finest men on the airways today. May wow. God bless you and your family always, John." That's a nice email.
Wow. Yes. Gosh, John, thank you. I don't know what to say. I appreciate it, but yeah, I mean, this is the thing. If you want to, I'll just recap and then we'll go back to the phone calls. Sometimes, and it happens because we're all human, you may hear something, it might strike you the wrong way, or maybe your own proclivities, whether they're political or what have you, it can induce a kind of thought-stopping process where rather than give the person the benefit of the doubt and see, is there some more benign way of looking at this? Did he mean it the way I'm taking it? Is it possible that he meant it in a way that's more understandable or something that's less problematic? And we should always try to look for those better possibilities unless it's absolutely ruled out. And I think being human, we have a tendency to do this. And that's an example of, I was talking yesterday about why I try to avoid politics because of that reason. And that email that was sent is a great example of what I'm talking about, where people get something so wildly wrong because they assume motives or they assume that they know what you really meant or, you know. So, you know, not to go back down that path again, but if anyone ever wonders, you know, shouldn't you talk more about politics? Well, one of the reasons I don't is just because people, they have a hard time with it. And let's just put it that way. And I think most people, gosh, Cyrus, do you remember, it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, where the big thing was Thanksgiving and Christmas and families being torn apart because some were for Donald Trump or some were against him and they wouldn't talk to each other and splits and rifts. Remember that?
Happened in my own family. Ugh. Yeah, I saw it firsthand.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and it got to the point you couldn't say, I couldn't have a, if I said one bad thing about either one of the candidates, then that meant I was in full support of the other one.
Right.
That's not the case. I can be critical.
Yeah, but you saw it. I never really had to go through that too much, but what you saw and what other people went through. I mean, I remember getting phone calls from listeners saying, you know, I'm really worried about Thanksgiving dinner because half my family is supporting one personage and the other is the other. And as far as we're concerned, or as far as they're concerned, we're the devil because we hold our political views. So I just don't see how that helps anybody.
No, in my family, that reconciliation has taken place. So the parties have come back together and they've said sorry to each other, and hopefully they can use this as something to grow and learn from. So in whenever this next election is, it doesn't happen again.
It will, unfortunately,
it will, but because we all have this collective amnesia and we just do the same things over and over again.
And I think another reason, too, is that people are so angry. People have just become so furious with each other and suspicious of each other that it. How do you have a balanced conversation in that kind of an environment? It's very difficult to do. So, well, thanks for reading that email, Cyrus. And thank you, John, for sending that in. I appreciate it. Here's an email that comes in from Christina just a little while ago, listening in San Diego on her 1000 AM station. She says, "Why do you never balance the SSPX community with the FSSP community, which is in full communion with the Catholic Church and still does only the traditional Latin Mass?" Christina, understand something. First of all, yes, St. Peter, Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, FSSP, I'm a big fan. I like what they do. I support what they do. And I'm always happy to comment on them. unless you're listening to all 3 hours of every show every day, is it possible maybe that you might have missed me talking about that? That's one thing. Second thing is, for any given question, I get these emails from time to time too. Well, you forgot to mention this, or you forgot to mention that, or you failed to. Please understand, especially within the confines of a three-hour program and we have breaks and whatnot. I'm not trying to make excuses, just give you context is all. You can't say everything about everything. And believe me, I typically tend to go in the direction of saying a lot more when it comes to answers. My answers tend to be longer, for better or for worse, so forgive me for that. Forgive me for that. But Christina, please, in your charity, please understand that in the limited time, I can't always pack every last other detail into a question that wasn't even in the first place about this for the FSSP. That's all. But thank you for taking a moment to write to me. Let's go to Sherry in Chandler, Arizona, that is. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Patrick.
Sure. Hello.
So my question is, I was listening to one of the callers that called in this morning, one of the first callers, and asking questions about your salvation. And so it's given me a lot of, confusion in my soul, I should say.
Okay.
So I guess I want to make sure I understand this right. Are you saying that the only way to heaven is by being a Catholic and attending a Catholic church?
Well, let me read it to you in the words of the Catholic Church herself. So this is going to be from the document I mentioned earlier called Lumen Gentium, and it's LumenGentium. And here goes. So this is section 14. I think it's easiest if I just simply say what the church says as opposed to trying to interpret it myself. So I'm going to just read you the entire section here. This sacred council wishes to turn its attention firstly to the Catholic faithful, basing itself upon scripture, sacred scripture and tradition. It teaches that the church, now sojourning on earth as an exile, is necessary for salvation. Christ, present to us in his body, which is the church, is the one mediator and the unique way of salvation. In explicit terms, he himself affirmed the necessity of faith and baptism, and thereby affirmed also the necessity of the church, for through baptism as through a door, men enter the church. Whosoever, therefore, knowing that the Catholic Church was made necessary by Christ, would refuse to enter or to remain in it, could not be saved. They are fully incorporated in the society of the church, who, possessing the Spirit of Christ, accept her entire system and all the means of salvation given to her, and are united with her as a part of her visible bodily structure, and through her with Christ, who rules her through the Supreme Pontiff and the bishops. The bonds which bind men to the church in a visible way are profession of faith, the sacraments, and ecclesiastical government and communion. He is not saved, however, who, though part of the body of the church, does not persevere in charity. He remains indeed in the bosom of the church, but, as it were, only in a bodily manner and not in his heart. All the church's children should remember that their exalted status is to be attributed not to their own merits, but to the special grace of Christ. If they fail, moreover, to respond to that grace in thought, word, and deed, not only shall they not be saved, but they will be more severely judged. So that's section 14, And I think it doesn't really require more amplification on my part, other than to say that the church also says that God wills the salvation of all people. So there may be people who just don't know, and that's what we call invincible ignorance. And we believe that God has mercy on them and can indeed save them, but in a way that he hasn't revealed to us. So what we have to go on is what was revealed to us by Jesus. And that is, as he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And that he wants all people in all places to be members of his church and to come in through the doorway of baptism. That's in Matthew 28, 19 and 20. So that is the church's teaching. It has always been the church's teaching. It hasn't changed. Vatican II reiterated it. So if that's the question you're asking, Sherry, there's the answer.
Well, yes. So this Lumen Gentium, is that in the regular Bible? Because I've never read that in the Holy Bible.
Yeah, it's not in the Bible, and it's Lumen Gentium, G-E-N-T-I-U-M. That is a document from Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council. It's not scripture. It's a it's the dogmatic constitution on the church. So it's an expression of the church's doctrine.
From the Catholic faith.
Right.
Right. So all these Christians that aren't going to a Catholic church who are following the Holy Bible and aren't reading and don't know this, then you're saying God will grant them mercy and grace and they'll still get to go to heaven because they did not know? Because nowhere in the Bible does it say that you can only go to heaven through by attending a Catholic church, that that is God's one and only church.
Right. Well, keep in mind that nowhere in the Bible does it say that you have to prove everything from the Bible either. So the Bible doesn't say just because it's not in the Bible, it can't be true. So keep that in mind.
It just gets so confusing. I mean, you want to live according to the Bible. That's supposed to be your instruction for life. And if all of us are getting it wrong out here, there's a lot of people that won't be in heaven. It sounds like it'd only be the Catholics in heaven.
Well, all I can tell you, Sherry, is that Jesus in the Bible, Matthew 28:19-20, he said to the apostles, go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations and to baptize them. And he says, teach them to observe all that I've commanded you. So it was this church that he established that he invites everybody to come into. And if somebody says, no, I don't want to do that, then, you know, I believe in coming to Jesus on his terms, not making him come to me on my terms. And since he's the one who established the church and he's the one who said everybody needs to be in this church, I believe him. And just going from scripture, I accept that teaching from Jesus and I want to come to him on his terms. And I believe you should do the same.
I agree. I just think that the Bible should be rewritten then and let everybody know that Catholic faith is the only way in God's eyes, and it doesn't say that, and it's misleading.
No, but it does say that. Read Matthew 28:19-20.
It doesn't say Catholic. It just says the only way to heaven is through admitting that God, Jesus died on the cross and rose, and we have to believe in him and go out and be the hands and feet of Jesus and be his disciples and spread the word. But it doesn't say that you don't have to be. It doesn't say in the Bible, but the Lord.
Do you believe in the Trinity?
Absolutely.
Okay. The Bible doesn't say anything about the Trinity. Doesn't use that word either. And yet it's true.
But if you believe that God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit is three in one, that is the Trinity.
Yes, but what I'm saying is you're complaining that the word Catholic or the term Catholic Church is not used in the Bible. All I'm pointing out is that nor is the Trinity as a term, but the church itself the church itself as Jesus established it is indeed the Catholic Church. In fact, you'll find it being called the Catholic Church by the end of the first century, beginning of the second century. It's already by then being referred to as the Catholic Church. And by men who knew the apostles. They learned the faith from the apostles. So,
right, I watched The Chosen. I learned the Bible more and more by watching The Chosen series.
Well, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
Happy about that.
The Chosen. Yeah. So my whole life I've been raised a Christian, and it just was just brought to my attention the other day. So it's given me a lot of heartburn because I'm thinking this whole time I've been learning and doing things wrong and going according to the Bible, and never did I know that really the only way your true salvation to heaven is through being a Catholic. And I just think so many Christians out there were getting it wrong then.
Well, this is a great reason, Sherry.
Aren't God's church, huh?
Yeah, this is such an important topic, Sherry. I do have to take a break, though. I hope you'll keep listening. And if you want, we can continue talking about that. If you want to call me in a week or so, we can get further in it. But please keep listening. And this is important to note that if you didn't know, you weren't aware, you were operating in good faith, we Catholics believe the Lord has mercy on you. He's not going to condemn you if you didn't know. Thanks, Sherry. Call me again, please. I'll be right back. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Thanks again for listening. Let's go to Joseph in Albuquerque. Good morning, Joseph. What's on your mind today?
Good morning, Patrick. I just wanted to call and support you on that comment about the priest in Brooklyn. You know, that's how I see it as well.
The Franciscan priest who had chained the doors of the abortion clinic, that one?
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, the story of this father of seven that was arrested, bringing his 12-year-old that everybody rallied around, I came to the same conclusion about him as well, and I said, well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm like, you know, why didn't you just remove your son from that situation? And, you know, you know better than pushing someone or something is going to have ramifications. And with seven kids and a wife, you know, that the Lord has given you a state in life.
Yeah. I see your logic, but I don't fault the father for what he did at all, because the other guy, the one who really was at fault for this, if you ask me, he had come around and he was shouting obscenities and crude sexual things and harassing the boy and the father verbally. And then, according to eyewitnesses, he got up right into his face, got right up to him, invaded his personal space. And that's when the father took action and shoved that guy away because he thought that the guy was trying to harm his son. And so I absolutely agree with what the father did. He did the right thing under the circumstances. I'm not negating your logic, saying like maybe he should have thought about that ahead of time, or maybe shouldn't have brought his son. But I mean, those are judgment calls. But I don't think what the father did in that moment was at all wrong. I think he did the right thing. So I don't see that as a parallel to the wisdom of chaining shut the doors of an abortion clinic. That would be a different kind of thing. You see where I'm coming from on that, Joseph?
I do, and I appreciate your guidance, because I was, you know, just looking at it from a standpoint of just, you know, just remove your son and don't jeopardize your family. And, you know, I don't know if taking, you know, hands-on action is really the road to go.
Well, look at it this way, Joseph. If you're, how old was the boy? 12 years old, 13, whatever he was. He was an adolescent. If you're in a place like that and some adult male had been harassing your son and making lewd sexual comments and then gets physically right up, right in your personal space, I'm pretty sure you would have done the same thing. I know I would have. You basically push that guy back because it's threatening. It shows the possibility of an imminent attack. If somebody's getting up in your face like that, I mean, it's a natural reaction, especially of a father who's defending his son. The circumstances were unfortunate.
I had that situation over the summer, actually, Patrick.
Oh,
I had
what
that
happened?
Situation with my son. I told him to watch his mouth, and it's none of his business. And I walked away, and I went to security. And I let the security personnel take care of removing him from the property that we were visiting.
So this was a man who was somehow harassing you and your son?
Yeah, he was harassing my son for wearing a mask outdoors.
Oh, okay.
And I said, it's really none of your business. But, you know, the point was that I think I took the proper action. You know, if someone's going to hurt my children physically, yes, I'm going to step in.
Right.
But I just don't see that, you know, jeopardizing all that's at stake there for your family was really a prudent and wise decision on his part.
Well, I suppose that's something that can be debated. I'm sympathetic toward him. I'm sympathetic toward what he did. But I could see where people would say, well, in retrospect, maybe you shouldn't have done it that way. I mean, okay, that's fair enough. But as far as the Franciscan priest, the Franciscan friar who chained the abortion clinic doors shut, are you, I want to make sure I know where you're coming from on that point. You're saying that you disagreed with him or you agree with him?
No, I disagree with him.
I see.
Just like you had said, you said, I don't think that was probably the best choice for him to make. And I agree, you know, and, you know, I appreciate your guidance because like I looked to you for guidance and I said, well, maybe I'm seeing this wrong. And now you've given me something to ponder, you know, about this father of seven. And I will mull that over. And
thank you,
you
Joseph.
Know, I appreciate your input.
Your humility is beautiful and admirable and edifying. So thank you for that. You know, my, as I was saying earlier, when we talked about it earlier in the show today, I'm in no way critical of this priest at all. I mean, I admire his courage. I admire his deep faith and willingness to undergo repercussions for standing up for life. So in no way am I trying to diminish the importance of what he's trying to do. I'm just saying that if you consider the range of options and what are some good ways that you might be able to advance the cause, is this an effective way that's actually going to accomplish something? And here again, I think reasonable people can have different viewpoints on that without in any way calling into question his motives or the or being critical of him. I'm not at all critical of him.
Oh, neither am I, Patrick. I'm a pro-lifer. You know, I'm always signing petitions from TFP and emails that are sent to me for years. You know, I believe in supporting the pro-life movement, absolutely.
It, yeah.
I just, you know,
same
there
here.
Are certain ways that I think Jesus doesn't want us, you know, breaking law or, you know, I don't know. I look to different scripture passages that...
Yeah, I hear you. I know what you mean, Joseph, and this life, it can at times be perplexing, and it's always true that 2020 vision is all, I'm sorry, hindsight is always 2020 vision. So we can look back on things and see more clearly, but in the moment, sometimes you just do the best you can under the circumstances, and that's really all you can do, because you're trying to do the right thing, and maybe in the future you'll look back and say, well, I could have done that differently, or I shouldn't have done that at all, but I don't think at all we should fault people who are trying to do the right thing. Thanks. Let's go now to Stephanie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi there.
I just wanted to offer some information about the theology behind what Father Fidelis does.
Mm-hmm.
We have a theology of solidarity, and only a few people are called to rescue like he does,
mm-hmm.
Because most people have a state in life where they could not do what he has done. And during when I was doing that a few years ago, we were very carefully trained to be nonviolent and to not do anything violent. But we wanted to not only protest against abortion, we also wanted to offer ourselves in solidarity with the unborn child as closely as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he is doing is offering himself really as a victim in the place of those unborn children that were scheduled to die there that day. And so it is a part of his priestly ministry that he does that, and he always does it in obedience to his superior at the Franciscan Friars.
Yeah, I don't doubt any of that. And I understand the theology and I concur with it. There obviously the victim soul phenomenon in the church is longstanding, so I don't take issue with any of that.
Okay. I just wanted to say, you know, practically, it looks like it would not be, practically speaking, chaining the doors appears to be a bad decision, but on the spiritual plane, it's something that he has felt called to do. Joan Andrews was someone who did this in the mm-hmm. 1980s.
I remember
and she
her.
Wrote a book called You Reject Them, You Reject Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her book that convinced me to become a rescuer. I can't do it anymore because of my state in life now. But at the time I was able to do it, it was very important that we be completely nonviolent. I will tell you that whether or not to use chains was a big controversy among rescuers. Some mm-hmm. people said yes, and some people said no. So that was.
I remember. Yeah, I had a very long conversation, one-on-one conversation with Randall Terry some years ago about this very issue. And of course, you know who he is. And so we spent hours talking one-on-one about this issue. And it was very, very helpful to me to kind of understand more deeply that aspect of these things. So I admire you and all those who are seeking to do what you do to help unborn children. I admire that very much. I'm glad that you're doing what you can do. So thank you for that.
I did want to tell you that Father Fidelis was...
We're out of time. I apologize, Stephanie. That's the clock talking, not me, but thank you. I'll be right back with more right after this.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on! I'm